Cine Marathon, the movie marathons podcast where we watch movie marathons all in one day and talk about them later. We are continuing our massive marathon of the James Bond movies. This is part four of the James Bond discussion. If you missed parts one, two, or three, go back and check those out. But if you're all caught up, then sit back and enjoy some more talk about James Bond.
Well, we bid adieu to Roger Moore, who did us a fine service.
Yeah, he did.
And we moved on to The Living Daylights with Timothy Dalton.
Oh, Timmy.
Which is good, by the way. Anybody that says Dalton wasn't a good Bond needs to check themselves before they wreck themselves.
I definitely agree with you, Matthew. I went into this like, oh, shit. Like, the next two movies are going to just suck because I've heard nothing but bullshit about Timothy Dalton.
I'm totally guilty of unfairly judging Timothy Dalton. My opinion of him completely reversed, and he jumped up about four slots on my James Bond meter. He was terrific. I would almost put him third, but I think he's still barely fourth.
I don't know. I think what I found interesting about it was, having never seen any Bond movies prior to Brosnan, was that I had an experience with Bond being fairly young. Like, Brosnan doesn't look really old.
Yeah,
he definitely
young.
Doesn't look Connery old or more old. You know what I mean? Starting back at the beginning, I had gotten used to, for 17 movies and what are we, like 30 years deep into this franchise now, of Bond being just an older man. And when Dalton showed up, it was like, who's this little rascal? Like, trying to take over. But, you know, it only took maybe 10 or 15 minutes for me to really get comfortable with it again.
Yeah.
Like, he really throws himself into it. He's a very physical Bond.
Yeah, he's no nonsense.
He's no nonsense. He shows up, and it was sort of the same reaction I had when I first watched the remake of Casino Royale, the newest Casino Royale, was it? He's a very physical Bond. And I don't know, I thought he revitalized it in more ways than one.
Yeah, I have to wonder how much of it is... I mean, I think he did a great job, but maybe the movie gets dogged on because most people, unlike us, go and see Bond movies every now and then. Mm-hmm. It's not something that you do all in one day. Maybe audiences wanted, you know, like the stock, like, Bond. I think they sort of come to it for familiarity. And I think for us, just having like a fresh take, kind of a new attitude for the marathon helps like immensely.
Yeah. It wouldn't have hurt to have a new James Bond every movie.
Yeah. And so, maybe we all shined up to it so much because we're like, oh, thank God it's like not the same shit that
but
we've
also,
seen for a day.
Like, it's an amazing movie. Like, it really has some incredible set pieces. And originally it was supposed to be Roger Moore for that movie, but he dropped out somewhere in pre-production. And they almost got Brosnan for it, but they wouldn't let go of him for Remington Steele.
But aside from Dalton, like, the rest of the crew is, like, the same old Bond crew. Like, it's
right.
The same director. It seems like they made a conscious decision to, like, we're going to go a little different with it because we got this new guy.
Yeah, I think especially the fact that it's from the same director is, like, a testament to, like, the reinvention, because it does not look like what we've seen before.
Yeah, not at all.
At all. Like, the cinematography stepped up, like, 10 notches.
One of the first break from that the old Hollywood style filming where it's like just wide shots and you know like you have characters walking around you know from knee up you know this movie really takes it in closer and it feels grittier, but by today's standards it wouldn't seem as much, but like compared to like falling in the middle of the Bond history, it definitely feels fresh and it definitely feels more modern than most.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
I feel like the plot, or at least how they handled the plot,
it lends itself a little bit more to a younger character. Like, I can't really picture an old James Bond riding a cello case.
That's right.
down.
Yeah, that cello stuff was... Like, there's a car chase / cello chase, which is amazing.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, the car chase is great because the car's got all kinds of cool stuff in it.
Yeah, and it's on, like, ice, right? Like,
there's a scene on ice.
Beats the shit out of Die Another Day, I'll tell you that much.
Yes.
Is this where they shoot out the tire and he uses the rim of the tire to cut
a
ring?
In the ice.
Brilliant.
Oh, yeah.
That was amazing.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable. Yeah, and then they take her cello, like bullet-ridden cello, and ride it, like, across the border.
The cello case.
Yeah,
they're holding it.
Oh, right.
She's holding the cello.
But they steer with the cello.
Oh, right. Yes!
The cello is the rudder of their ski.
He's got it on the back, and they couldn't look more suave or calm as, like, bullets fly.
I would love to see me trying to use a cello rudder. I would die, probably.
And this story takes us all over. It takes us from Eastern Europe to Vienna to like the deserts.
Afghanistan,
yeah,
right?
To the deserts, to the snow. It just goes everywhere. And everywhere they go, it's action. And the plot of the story, the plot is really cool. You know, a Russian, who they think is a Russian defector, who pretends to be recaptured just so they could set up that John Rhys Davies, who plays like this Russian politician, to be assassinated.
And then he like fakes his own death. Right?
Yeah, he and Bond team up to fake his death. And it's not like they shoot like blanks and he has fake blood spurts. He's wearing a bulletproof vest with a blood pack over it.
It's the best
and,
fake death ever.
And
like,
Bond,
he takes it like a champ.
Yeah, Bond has to be a good shot to kill him.
Man, he really had faith. Like, he's just like, fuck it. Like, shoot real bullets at me.
Yeah, remember, remember the first gun we see Bond use in this movie? It's like, oh, I'm going to pull my gun out of this case here. And it's got like 8 scopes on it. It like, couldn't be more like out of a video game.
It's like, are you a Navy SEAL all of a sudden?
He's
what
playing
just happened?
Silent scope.
Or... Yeah, like it was such a great introduction for like him being a reinvented Bond. Because Roger Moore would have never pulled that gun out, you know?
Timothy Dalton as Bond, like, ain't nothing to fuck with.
No.
Like, he is, wow. Like,
he feels more on edge to me as a character. Like, I feel like Moore and Connery were, like, the kings of keeping it cool. Mm-hmm. But, like, Dalton brought this energy of, I know how to do my job. I know how to do it well.
And
but
I just did a line of coke.
Exactly. there's, like, this weird, like, I'm sort of on the edge. I could go a little nuts on you if you don't. Like, if you keep fucking with me. It was an interesting transition.
I mean, he's not an ugly man, but he doesn't have that, like, super suave, like, real debonair handsome look. He's just kind of, he's got, like, a butt chin, and, like, he just looks, like, almost like a thug.
Literally, of the 8 people who have played James Bond, I would argue that he is probably the least attractive.
Yeah.
Regular attractive.
I think the guy from Climax might.
No, he's got that old Pat Sajak letter turning thing going on.
I don't know. I'm going Lazenby, least attractive.
No, Lazenby was gorgeous. Are you kidding?
Oh, funny face.
The baby face. He's beautiful.
Oh, and this has Jodan Baker in it.
Oh, right. Yeah.
But like most of us know Jodan Baker is like the nutty CIA agent from the new Bond movies. But he's like a villain in this one.
Yeah, he pulled a Maude Adams.
And I really remember, I don't know why this sticks out to me, but he had like a shoulder strap that he always tucked his hat under, and it looked like so goofy. He just was always like had his hat under his shoulder.
That's
I guess
what
that's
it's
like
for.
That is what it is.
Hat strap.
Fuck it, no.
That strap down.
I guess that makes sense. I guess why else would you have a strap?
But
I never saw anyone use it.
To keep your shoulders from falling off.
But he had like this whole like his whole like personal office was rigged up to like this RCA remote, which was clearly like a television remote. And he would just like randomly like gesture
buttons. The button always knew what he
right,
wanted.
Right, he was like the Oogie Boogie of like
like everything like that. He had like live cannons ready to shoot at someone if they hit around this corner.
That part is a drag to me, but before that, the movie's great. But up until we get to that guy, it's not so good.
Yeah,
they drive a car out of a crashing plane.
The final
that was
great.
Amazing.
Oh, that was
great.
Right. That was awesome. So amazing.
Wait, what?
So they're in a plane, and it's like fucking crashing, and they drive like a car out of it.
Oh,
because,
yeah.
Wait, we're like skipping pitch. Over like a big part of
the
what
big reason why.
Okay, so there's a James Bond in the back because he's left his loyal assistant, this feature film's Bond girl, in the cockpit alone.
A cello player.
Now, she doesn't know that just because she's the only person left in the cockpit that she's supposed to fly the plane. But
hey,
so she just reaches around and flips at levers instead of grabbing those 2 big things right in front of her. And she flips a lever that opens the back of the plane, more likely endangering James Bond than the villain.
I thought she did that on purpose.
Yeah,
she did it on purpose.
Even if she did it on purpose, it was a very dumb, like, miscalculated risk.
I don't know.
I think she did it on purpose, and I kind of like that because it shows that she has confidence in Bond.
Yeah.
And
I don't think she thought that deep into it.
Well,
honestly, she doesn't seem like
the
brightest
bulb. I don't care. Honestly, screw you guys, because that was awesome.
Okay, well, as evidence, I want to exhibit A here. After James Bond pushes this guy out of the plane, James Bond goes back to the cockpit to, like, reconvene with his mistress. And they're like, oh, thank God. And then she turns and looks out the front window and realizes it's been pointed directly at a cliffside. And she just starts screaming like a fucking idiot.
She, you know, she was caught up in Bond and his fighting and, you know, how it would go.
I just imagine, like, if that were a motorhome, she would have done the same thing. Like, it wouldn't have mattered that it was a complicated piece of equipment. Like, honestly, she would have been like, oh, I forgot driving.
Yeah, the plane was out of fuel, which, you know, they bail out. Yet when it crashes, it still explodes.
Yeah.
I'm not quite sure what explodes in a plane that's empty.
The fumes explode. Yeah.
There were nukes on that plane.
But it was a pretty big explosion for an empty plane. I don't know.
But I think it's one of the other ways they really tried to up the movies. Like, I feel like with the stunts, they were like, you know, we've been doing Bond stunts for all these years. Let's go, like, fucking crazy with the stunts.
Yeah, let's take it back to fucking horses jumping off castles.
Yeah, the whole car, plane thing. I mean, we've been watching stunts and action all, like, for hours and hours and hours, and we were all like, whoa! Like, it was, like, really awesome.
Yeah, that definitely stood out.
And this one has the guy gets chopped in half by the automatic door. Which we don't get to see.
Oh, yeah.
We don't get to see it, but we just know
it's bad. Yeah.
You know, the villain's got the door rigged, and the guy's walking out this sliding door, and you just see the door slam, and the guy's out of frame, but you see the door slam so hard that the glass shatters.
Yeah.
And then Bond goes and looks over the body, but you never see the body. So you know it's really bad. I mean, so bad that they knew that they couldn't do the makeup or visual effect to make it look as bad as it
would have been rated R.
Yeah.
Did he even have a quip, or did he just look and be like, damn? Like,
no,
this wasn't someone he wanted to die, was it?
No.
It was an agent that he was like familiar with. It
was like a very trend.
So, like, it was just like some like witty retort for like, oh, my friend just died, don't let the door hit you on the way out.
I'd have done it. So the next was, sadly, Timothy Dalton's final, License to Kill.
But a good one.
Another good
Great one.
Yeah, it's, like, it's tough following Living Daylights, because I wouldn't say it was nearly as good as that movie. And it felt a little long to me, mm-hmm. but I did like that they just didn't fuck around and, like, cut Felix Leiter's, like, leg off at the beginning of the movie.
And killed his wife.
Yeah, it got, like, hardcore. I know.
Yeah.
But they, I mean, it's kind of somewhat their fault because they go out on a mission, like, on the wedding day.
Yeah.
They're being
Wait,
real
did Felix
cocky.
Go out on the mission, though? Or...
No, yeah. He suited up.
It was Felix's mission.
Yeah, we mentioned that it was like the beginning of The Incredibles. It's like, oh, I'm on the way to the altar, but oh, I can fit one last mission in.
It was, I mean, that movie, Bond's best friend gets fucked up by a shark.
Right, it like bites his leg off.
Yeah, bites his leg
well,
off.
Well, he's being horribly balanced by chunk of meat.
Yeah, it was like a weird like scale where there's meat on one end of the chain, and then there's
Leiter's
on the other side.
End of the chain.
Oh, right.
And so the shark can only take a bite of one side at a time, and they're constantly trading places as their weight is shifting back and forth. It's supposed to be his fate in an earlier film, they weren't able to shoot it that way at the time, and they ended up recycling it into this one.
Oh, yeah, okay. But it's a pretty pivotal like plot point, because the rest of the movie, he's just like Jack Bauered up and like ready for blood.
Yeah.
And
that's what I love. I think that's why I like this movie so much, is because it's like, It's appropriately named. Like, he has a license to kill, and he's gonna fucking use it. Almost a precursor to the more recent movies, the Daniel Craig Bond. Timothy Dalton loses his cool a little bit.
That's when he goes rogue, right?
Yeah, it's when he goes rogue.
Yeah, he's not even under, you know...
Cover of MI6.
MI6 is, like, irrelevant to Bond.
But interestingly enough, I read online that I think the original title they had was License Revoked.
Really?
Because it's like he goes rogue and, like, leaves the agency.
That's
so it was
going
to be License Revoked. But then people, like, I guess they pitched it to people and everything.
They just thought it was
a
sequel to License to Drive.
Yeah. Well, apparently, they were like, hey, in the States, people are going to think he lost his, like, driver's license. Like, you need a better... better title.
It's like, and then, Greyhound it everywhere.
Yeah. So then they were like, oh, okay, well, License to Kill, we'll do that. But the, in a weird way, that as dumb as that title is, it's like a little more accurate to what they're going for. Like, officially, he doesn't really have the license anymore.
No,
he's like left.
But Q comes in to, like, to give him some support.
Right.
And hangs
right.
out with him, like, the whole movie. And there's two Bond girls and, like, the one's like really a badass gun nut.
Was she the one that whined the whole movie?
Yeah, well,
no,
this
the, with the short hair.
No, that was the other. That was
it was
other
amazing
one.
Because there were two Bond girls that really got equal time. Yeah. There was like a Latina girl.
Yeah.
And then like your standard like white girl with short hair.
Boop.
And the great thing was like the room was totally divided.
Yeah. It's like perfectly divided. And and honestly, I mean, clearly the Latina girl was way hotter.
Yeah.
Thank you, Matthew.
She was hotter, but I think
Why don't we let James Bond decide?
Yeah.
Oh,
which he did.
Oh, right. At the end of the movie he goes with the not your chick.
And that's why it was his last movie.
But his choice is really weird because he's with the Latina girl kisses her.
Yeah, this is probably the most womanizing and awesome Bond is in any of the movies because he's literally standing between them, makes out with one, he goes, you know what? I think I'm going to take a trip over here
this
one.
And he dives off the balcony into the pool next to the other one.
Because the girl has like a pout, like she sees him kissing the other girl and she's like, oh, golly gee, and like is all sad.
Yeah.
And then he just rolls in like, what's up? And they just make out like she has no protest.
Yeah.
Like,
so apparently Bond's got a soft spot for kind of cute
girls
with boy haircuts. That's what the lesson here is.
I also want to point out that this movie represents about 60% of my argument for Timothy Dalton over Daniel Craig as a James Bond. Because I don't think that James Bond would ever lose his shit over a girl and go crazy like this, but it's believable that he would do it over his like partner and like trusted ally in hundreds of missions beforehand.
But wait a second.
He does lose his cool over a girl
in
Diamonds Are Forever when he's
going
around.
No, I'm saying
Timothy
Dalton is a better James Bond than Daniel
Craig. I mean,
Timothy Dalton was not in Diamonds Are Forever.
Is this plot or is this actor?
By equal measure, if you use that as a rule, then after On Her Majesty's Secret Service, Connery goes a little nutso over his wife being murdered.
Right. Yeah, and a woman who he never would have married if he'd appeared in On Her Majesty's Secret Service.
But that's you can't accept that as non-canon. It is directly it's a direct sequel. His wife gets killed and Connery goes a little crazy.
Okay,
they
mention it in this one too.
Well, I just want to point out that Sean Connery nor George Lazenby are Timothy Dalton. Timothy Dalton is a better James Bond.
Okay,
but
you're
That's
using it
point.
As a comparison to Craig, and Craig didn't write these movies, and neither did Connery when he got written in after his wife gets murdered on Her Majesty's
Well,
Secret
obviously
Service.
You can't blame an actor for the movie they're in.
Exactly.
Well, so it's not Daniel Craig's fault that his movies are terrible.
Okay.
I see what you're saying.
We'll get there.
Thank you. Thank
we'll
you for
there.
Your point.
I will acquiesce
Craig,
to that.
Yeah, the Daniel Craig movie debate.
Yeah.
Is forthcoming.
Yeah.
I'm sure it will be much heated.
You mean the Bourne supremacy debate?
I think we're missing something very important about License to Kill.
And what is that?
Wayne Newton.
Yeah.
Oh,
yes.
Right.
Yes.
As the
Bless
religious freak.
Yeah. Bless your heart.
And Benicio del Toro. He's in it too.
Yeah.
Benicio del Toro.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, Wayne Newton.
And we got Davi there too, right?
Yeah, Robert Davi. And Anthony Zerbe, who some of you guys might know, but I know. Was like he's an older actor, like, you know, like big in the 60s and 70s.
Wait, which one was he?
He was the guy who got, like, they put him in that decompression chamber and he cranked it all the way up to
high
pressure.
Oh, the microwave thing.
You missed that, I think.
No.
I think you left the room.
I might have been taking a shower.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
You
so
missed that.
So they put this guy in, it's a decompression chamber, but they crank it up to high pressure. And then Robert Downey takes an axe and just, like, breaks the air hose. And you just see this guy go, and his head just explodes.
His head explodes
like
on
scanner
camera.
Style?
Yeah, scanner style. You
almost,
see his head explode.
Almost.
Overall, the plot, the villain's plot is drugs. It's all about drugs. And Wayne Newton's role was, he was telling the drug runners who was bidding. Like who was bidding for the drug deal. Like, he would say, oh, someone from Akron, you know, it was like a code, is just donated $6,000. So, like, that was, like, their key.
Right.
Oh, okay.
And he was also, like, the fit face of, like, the legitimate business,
yeah, exactly.
You know?
But the whole plot of the cocaine that could be soluble in gasoline and then re-extracted.
That's perfect. The perfect crime.
Oh, well, That's pretty horrible.
It's the perfect setup for an amazing action sequence, which ends this movie too.
Yeah,
that was incredible.
Yeah, but yeah. And he fucking puts a big old tanker truck on like half its side. Like,
yeah like, that was awesome.
Because they dodge do that a rocket. In Diamonds Are Forever, he does it with like a car, and you're like, whoa! But this is like, oh
he
my
also
God.
Fucks that up, kind of.
Yeah.
You know, when he puts the tanker truck up on the on half. To dodge a bazooka round.
Right, like a missile.
I was just like, what?
Yeah, you're in a truck full of gas, and you dodge a missile.
Cocaine like, gas, man.
Does anyone else have anything on License to Kill? I feel like we're kind of glazing over it, but at this point, you know, we were getting pretty tired. That's all I got.
Gladys Knight's score is kind of lame.
Yeah, I wasn't a fan.
It's okay. That's the one that's like, License to Kill.
I think this was the start of people getting really crappy finisher songs.
But I think that Gladys Knight's lyrics... And her singing, you know, we're singing, I don't know, it may be me last night, I don't know. But I think the actual song itself is pretty cool. Like, because it's got those really cool, like, backbeats from
like,
John Barry. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like it becomes, like, part of a kind of a Bond score.
Which sounds like Goldfinger.
Yeah. I think the song itself was good. It was the lyrics and the singing of the song. That made it
well to me it's also like the pace of the song like it's a real sultry slow like the movie's about him like fucking ripping heads off you'd think we'd get some like Metallica on
or
that
some,
or something
some
like.
Slipknot
this song is definitely a sleeper.
And wait, and doesn't he set the villain on fire? Like, isn't at the end, like, the villain's covered in gasoline?
Yeah.
He ignites Felix's lighter.
Oh, right. Because he's... Because awesome. The guy, like so many Bond movies, the villain has him, like, fucking dead to rights. Like, ready to go. And instead of just, like, blowing him away, like anyone should, Bond's like, hey, wait a minute. And he's like, oh, okay. I'll let you reach into your pocket. There's no way you could possibly kill me.
Also,
and then he's like, later,
Isn't there a little insult to injury there where he's like, oh, by the way, I don't know if you know, but I killed your brother a second ago. And then he lights him on fire.
Right.
Yeah.
One last thing about this. I hated that Robert Downey had, like, a lizard with a diamond
necklace.
Like, Jub-Jub or whatever.
What the shit is that about? Like, why?
It's decadence.
Why do you need that?
And also, he just walks away from it at a party. Like,
yeah, he
no one's
going to
steal my lizard covered in diamonds.
There was another weird moment. I don't know if you guys remember when Q first comes in. He's got all these gadgets. And some of the gadgets are pretty ridiculous. Like the camera gun.
Yeah.
Right. That only can shoot, would only shoot if he used it, which never came into play.
Yeah.
Like, no one ever tried to grab the camera gun.
Must have been cut or something.
But the girl takes a picture with a Polaroid camera, which Q freaks out about. And when she does it, it shoots a laser at a portrait as Q and Bond both dive out of frame.
Oh, yeah.
But when the picture comes developed, it took an x-ray of Q and Bond, but there's also a skeleton behind the portrait. And it was just like, what? I don't know what this is supposed to be.
The painting somehow had, like, skeletons.
Well, it's well known that some of the Flemish artists would paint a skeleton first.
Yes.
And then all the flesh onto the skin.
They paint it out of bone marrow.
Yeah.
It was such a weird moment that didn't really make any sense.
Yeah, it
at
doesn't
all.
Fit into the context of this, like, of Timothy Dalton's universe.
They're
and
like, say cheese and die.
Yeah, that single frame was later adapted by R.L. Stine into an entire book.
Golden
Eye, I found his weakness. Golden Eye, you'll do what I please. Golden Eye, no time for sweetness, but a bitter kiss will bring him to.
All right, well, we bid adieu to Timothy Dalton. It was short but sweet with him.
Yeah.
And we go to
6 years in the future.
The new era, or our era, I think once we're kind of age.
Yeah.
So kind of our Bond, which is Pierce Brosnan in GoldenEye.
Yeah.
Right.
Which is awesome.
Holy
damn right.
Shit, is
Bond
GoldenEye
is back.
Good.
Yeah. From like frame one, you're like, holy shit.
Yeah.
Like this movie, it's got a lot of favorites in it for me. I don't know how much of that is nostalgia, but this definitely, like, I know it's not just nostalgia. This, the opening sequence of this, like, at the end of it, how he rides a motorcycle off of a cliff.
Yeah.
Oh my god.
And then dive bombs into a falling airplane.
Yeah. Then lifts it up.
And then gets in the airplane, lifts it up.
Yeah.
Yep. And then flies through the explosion of the place he just fucked
They like
up.
One-upped Living Daylights.
Yeah.
So like.
I don't know how you can top top that. That is amazing.
That is that might be just my favorite set piece out of the Bond franchise.
And, like, well, I don't know about the Bond franchise, but definitely for that movie.
It was a really unique sequence in that it was years before the actual story takes place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
like
a gambit.
Yeah,
it was like a backstory.
Yeah, it wasn't like this just happened. This was like 9 years before we get into the movie. Definitely years before.
Great cold open.
Like, yeah, and so it's just like, you know, okay, well, you know, this is getting into it, but it was also, you know, they were still using miniatures and models, which was great because, like, you know, it was obviously a model of when the thing is exploding, but it wasn't, you know, obviously CGI hadn't gotten that good yet, so they were still using semi-practical effects, cheaper effects, but practical effects. And the whole movie would continue to use that, even for the space stuff, which looked pretty lame. But luckily, you don't see too much of it.
So now, World Is Not Enough is also, like, he's in prison for a long amount of time, right?
That's
Dino Day.
That's Dino Day.
Okay, because it seems like Pierce Brosnan, even though he's only in the four movies that were in a pretty tight window, he's supposed to span quite a long age of James Bond if, like, two of his movies include, like, 12 years.
I think at this point, they sort of make Bond almost like timeless.
Yeah,
he's always,
because they have, I mean, Q's still in the movie, right? Mm-hmm. So we're to believe that, like, this Q is the Q from the beginning and Bond's a Bond from the beginning, but he's like a young dude.
Yeah,
and Q's like old as time.
Yeah,
so at a certain point, like, I think they just let go of the logic of, like, I don't think they care, like, how many years or whatever.
Well, I liken it to the Jack Ryan movies. I mean, none of those movies are really are in any kind of order. It's just a character in a situation. It's you know, they do reference things that have happened, but every time we're introduced to Bond, it's a new kind of Bond in a new situation. It's a character in a situation, not a chronological story arc that we've been watching all this time. It's great that they have the Q, you know, the same Q and everything, but every time I see Bond, I just assume that this is a new story unrelated to anything that we've already seen.
Well, that really speaks to almost like the timelessness of James Bond. It goes on for so long, and it's almost like every generation or every era, they're like, here's our James Bond. And, like, Pierce Brosnan was like sort of the 90s Bond.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, Pierce Brosnan, he is an amazing Bond.
He's really good.
He's very classy. I think he may be the classiest Bond.
To me, it kind of, he harkens back to that kind of Sean Connery vibe, I think, better than anyone else after Sean Connery. Like, Connery had that vibe that was like,
okay, that, like, badass,
like panty dropping look of, like, you buy that this guy could just fuck any woman, like, problem.
But I think like he was saying, though, that Pierce Brosnan looks like sharper than any of those guys.
Yeah,
like, you put him in a tux and he looks
very dapper.
He's a dapper gent.
When I think James Bond, like, regardless of the actors that have portrayed him over the years, he is the embodiment of what I think James Bond should be.
Yeah, he's Tuxedo Bond
he's
for
classy,
me.
Man.
And they really make an effort in the movie to sort of bring back that old school Bond.
Right.
Like, he's playing Baccarat, he's in a tuxedo, he's like dry martini or vodka martini, shaken, not stirred. Like, they hit all the, like, cliche, like, classic stuff.
These were the movies that I started with. Like I said, I had only seen Brosnan and Poe, like, after that for me, like, going into this marathon. So there may be some nostalgia element for me, but I totally agree with, like, Pat and Jackson that when I think of Bond, like, now having done the marathon, Connery, it definitely holds this spot as, like, yeah, that's James Bond. Like, this is where it starts. He's kind of kooky, but he's also, like, a ladies' man. And there's something to be said for Connery. I think he might be actually my favorite Bond. But there's something about Brosnan where I feel like if he hadn't caught such bad luck with some of the movies that are coming up, like, the scripts that he was given, that he would be an easy contender for being one, like, the, like, number one or two Bond for me in the entire franchise.
Can you imagine if before GoldenEye he had done Living Daylights and License to Kill?
And,
you know, there was a 6-year gap there that there was, like, politics going on. He could have been making movies in that, too.
Yeah.
Like, he could have had 7, 8 movies.
He would have easily surpassed more for me just as being, like, what I would say. It's sort of like The Matrix. It's like when you go in, you have a mental image of yourself of, like, what that should be. Brosnan easily fits that definition for me as far as Bond.
Absolutely. Again, like, I love Timothy Dalton, but if he were in License to Kill, like, that movie would have been amazing. And I completely agree with you, Matthew. Like, if he were given better scripts other than, like, I like Tomorrow Never Dies. It wasn't as good as GoldenEye, in my opinion. But if, like, he was given better scripts, he would definitely probably be my favorite Bond. Although Brosnan has, what, like four films, those scripts didn't do him justice as an actor.
Yeah, definitely.
And the like, aside from Brosnan, who's, like, amazing, the action in GoldenEye is so good. Like, is it Martin Campbell who directs it? Who also directed Casino Royale.
Yeah.
Like, of all, if they were going to say, like, who do you want to direct the next Bond movie or any of them ever, like, I would just point to that guy.
Yeah. Definitely.
And be like, he just, any action, he knocks it out of the park every time.
I'd be like, give it to Hunt. I want this overshot and underedited.
But it's, in a weird way, like, as much as I love GoldenEye, it's so hard to watch the movie and not think of the video game.
Yeah.
Because, especially for our generation, like, the video game's such a, like, iconic, like, we played that game thing a million times, and I don't know if Rare got, like, a fucking tour of the set or something, like,
yeah,
they, like,
scene for scene.
Nailed, like, the look of those sets.
Well, like, you remember me the first 15 minutes, I'm sure I was pretty annoying, because every time they cut, I was like, that's from the video game! Like, I couldn't have been more entranced by how perfectly it was matched up, and I think what was interesting about that is, GoldenEye being my first Bond introduction, I actually had more knowledge of the game than I even had of GoldenEye the movie.
Sure. I think a lot of people do.
I think that's true for most people who play video games, at least. And, you know, like, it was really interesting for me to go back and see, not only this was my first Bond movie I had interacted with, but to go back and see it as being a representation or the source material for maybe one of my favorite video games ever. It was a really interesting translation.
But I think it shows that Rare, the company that made that game, like, they clearly watched the movie
way too much, but figured
out all the scenes in the movie and really adapted them well to, like, a video game environment. Because the video game wasn't, like, one-to-one the movie. Like, there were levels that weren't really there.
Yeah.
Things were different. And it's almost, like, in a weird way, like, a kind of a detriment to the movie that you're so distracted by how accurate the video game was.
I can see that.
Yeah. The whole time, like, it was almost, like, hard for me to watch sometimes because I'm like, oh, shit, that's the level from here. That's the level from here.
But it is funny when we're watching the movie and we're just like, dude, if he just knew there was a club in that room, he would be fine in this scene. And he just walked right past the body armor.
Yeah.
What an idiot.
But I was really in the game. I was really missing the level where you get to fight Xena on a top.
Yeah.
Sauna.
In a sauna.
Because, like, I mean, we've seen a lot of, like, sexy Bond stuff in all the movies, but that was, like, pretty sensual. Yeah. Like, she's orgasmic. Making, like, orgasm sounds.
Yeah. We need to know that she killed men by having sex with them, and then it's death by snoo-snoo.
Yeah. Well, like, crushing them with her thighs?
Yeah,
like,
she crushes them with her thighs. Like, that's awesome. Like, if somebody were like, Jackson, how would you die? Like, how, like, you are going to die tonight. How will you die? And I would be like, I'd be like, you need to get Jansen on the phone.
She's one of my favorite Bond girls.
Well, like, certainly of, like, villain Bond girls, the best one, like, easily.
You know, she's like, she gets, like, these orgasmic thrills at it killing people.
Yeah.
Or Spain in general.
Or just firing a gun. She shoots a gun, it's like, oh, like.
Yeah.
I don't know. I didn't think she was especially attractive, though. And I actually think that this movie has probably, on average, the least attractive Bond girls.
I would actually sort of agree, which, before this, I would have been really pissed at you, because I actually think Famke Jensen's incredibly attractive.
Not in this movie.
Not in this movie, actually. Yeah. There's something, I don't know what it is.
And Natalia is, like, blah.
I don't know. I don't know if we were watching the same movie.
I think
I was, like, high boners during this movie.
I had a regimen the whole movie, too. I mean, like, honestly.
John, Mr. Pillow Lap over here.
You watch the time lapse, and I'm, like, mysteriously hiding something.
Honestly, like, I think she was hot as hell in this movie. And I also think...
I'll second that.
Thank
right
you.
Here.
I also think Natalia was pretty damn hot in this movie.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons... She wasn't, like, amazing, like, drop-dead gorgeous hot, but she was definitely cute.
I wouldn't say she was remotely attractive.
This was 95?
Like, yeah. But, like, also...
I'm calling a little bit of a 95 problem here. I think that both of these women...
Yeah, you got your mid-90s goggles on.
Yeah, you got the mid-90s, like blur effects going on.
It may not be a factor that I was kid and saw this movie and was like, whoa!
Yeah, definitely.
May or may
not. Also, the reason I like Natalia is because she's... It's like Die Hard. She's like the John McClane of Bond girls. Because, well, like, I don't know, think about it.
She is elite hacker, though. I mean, she's pretty good.
Yeah, she's breaking the code. She's useful, and, you know, she is, like, the lone survivor of, like, this horrible incident involving treason. I don't know. I think the plot of this movie is really good.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Totally. She and those people in that place are babysitting two Cold War relics.
Yeah.
I mean, they were launched up there during the Cold War to be used against whoever, but the Cold War is over, and now, you know, what are they doing with them? They can't get them back down, but they're hanging on to them for who knows. You know, they might come in useful. You know, Trevlin, you know, 006, Sean Bean.
He's awesome.
Boromir.
Yeah, I mean, he's just the best ever.
He'd be a good Bond.
Yeah, he would if he wasn't a villain.
If he wasn't blonde, you know, that just doesn't make sense.
Yeah, you know, this was his revenge / ripping off plot. Everything about it was good, and I really like this movie just because of that feeling you get because Bond was back, and he came back in a really good way. You know, this was a Bond of our generation, and it was a solid movie. On par with a lot of other good Bond movies.
Yeah, it was a great setup. It was sort of like Obama coming into office. It was like,
yes, we can make a good Bond movie.
We're back, baby. But
I will say, though, what totally, in my at least for me, did not hold up was the whole, like, Boris
does not
fucking
hold up.
I'm invisible. Like, that shit was pretty bad.
Yeah, that,
like,
didn't hold up at all.
And I like him. What's the... I forgot
Alan
his
Cumming.
Name.
Alan
Cumming. I actually liked him when the movie came out, but now having seen it, I was just kind
of
like...
Maybe it's like a thing of, like, it just doesn't hold up nowadays, but yeah.
Something about it doesn't work. Anyway.
Well, not... He didn't suck. It was just... It was not funny.
Yeah.
Like, maybe it's the whole hacker thing. Like, maybe
that's it. And his half-assed Dennis Nedry riddles.
Yeah.
Like, of course, what do you sit on but you don't take with you, really? That's the hardest
riddle. A chair?
Like, that's your hardest fucking riddle? Like,
that was, like, to me, like, the go-to answer. I was like, the whole movie, I was like, what's the answer?
It
would have
thrown me off if the answer was ass, and I'd be like, oh, I get it, well, but you take that with you, too.
All of his previous answers had been vulgar to other questions for other passwords. And that's what was throwing all the characters off. All
right, well, this should bring us to the big debate of Judi Dench, because we haven't talked about her yet.
God,
but she's introduced as M. Now, I'll go on record. I might be in the minority. I don't know. But I actually really like Judi Dench.
Yeah, I like her as well.
I don't like her as M. Yes, I agree with you.
Also, Richard, hottest Bond girl, easily.
Yes.
That's like saying, I really liked the hat rack in all the earlier James Bond movies.
Thank you, Pat.
It didn't do anything.
It was
just stood there in the corner.
It was a vital part of the story.
Another case where Judi Dench pulls in a whole bunch of recognition for doing absolutely fuck nothing.
You know what, Matthew? She does a damn good job doing fuck nothing. So
I think she spends the next 6 movies looking at a giant map and being worried. But it's oh my God, where's James Bond? He stopped blipping.
It's not like Bernard Lee is M in the other movies, like, came in fucking juggling.
Yeah,
no, but he's not Dame Bernard Lee either.
It's meant to be like a deadpan, serious thing. And I kind of like, I know it's sort of weird to have this sort of like feminist kind of like take on it. We're like, oh, we'll put a woman in charge and now Bond's got to deal with this.
Oh, wait, she's a woman?
Yeah. I feel like they put her in there as almost like to make the girlfriends happy in kind of a way of like, Bond has this reputation of being like a misogynist and now 90s women are like, they're not going to put up with that. So we have this like, Judi Dench comes in and kind of like, knocks him down a peg, and I feel like that makes the pill a lot easier to swallow for a lot of people.
Well, you know, Judi Dench is probably just in this because Helen Mirren turned it down, so.
Oh, yeah. Man, if Helen Mirren, she could be a Bond girl.
Name any middle-aged actress or slightly older that, you know, is of any prominence today and would have been M instead of Judi Dench, I guarantee she would have been better.
Are you talking English women or what?
Yeah, just anything. Like she brings nothing to the table except stone-facedness and being a bitch, which is what she does in every movie.
To me, it's like that's what the part required. M is just a straight, you know, here's your mission, and very, like, cold. And I feel like that's what it was.
There's a charm to the previous M's.
But M is not Bond's friend.
He's
not like, you know, oh, good job, 007.
Yeah. Well, she certainly acts like it in the future movies.
He, he was, M was always just like, you gotta get this job
done. Figure.
Yeah, M was like, this is what the fuck needs to happen, and you're gonna do
but
it.
But see, that's why I think I have a problem with her representation of M, and I can't attribute it necessarily to her, but that they give her more of a character to the point where that she needs to have those scenes, and then ultimately it doesn't work with the way she's presented.
Are you talking Goldeneye? No, or are you talking her entire run?
Just M's
mostly
run.
Mostly the Brosnan run.
Her Brosnan run at the very least is like, M is supposed to not be like Bond's friend, but really she's there quite a bit.
Yeah, and her character arc is more of a character line.
Yeah.
Because she's the same bitch at the end.
She's supposed to have this background and this interesting engagement with Bond, but she's ultimately flat.
Well, I agree it is like a bit of stunt casting where it's like, oh, let's have a big name and she... Like, in a weird way, I mean, we'll get to it later, but I think they do go places in the newer movies with her, where she does have a lot more of, like, a character
and
a reputation.
And I would say it's more justified, and
I'm
going to step outside of my semi-irrational hatred of Dench for a moment and say that...
It's all irrational.
That she does present a little bit more dynamically the character of M in the Daniel Craig movies, but it's still not enough for me.
Like, I'll agree for, like, by the time Die Another Day rolls around, it's sort of like she needs to have another act. But I think for the purposes of Goldeneye, like, she's totally fine.
Yeah.
Because it's an introduction to that character. She doesn't,
and
she's
not
in
it that much.
Yeah. She just sort of says, oh, hey, Bond, I've heard about you.
It's kind of a cameo.
You
know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A throwaway role.
Which is the most tolerable she can ever be in any type of role as a cameo, so...
Oh, my God.
But she gets Oscars for those.
Second
anyway,
only
so.
To camo roles, where you don't even see her in the background.
Dame Judi Dench, I know you're listening to this podcast. We sincerely apologize.
What did we? What was the name we came
Lame
up with?
Lame Snooty Stench?
Yeah, exactly. Lame Snooty Stench.
Lame Snooty Stench. Are we forgetting anything else about GoldenEye?
Great theme song.
Yeah, that was Winslow's favorite, actually.
No, not really.
Yeah.
I actually...
Tina Turner. Tina Turner.
I actually do not like this.
Really?
This is Matthew's favorite.
I unknowingly, not knowing who composed it or wrote or anything, put it as my third least favorite Bond theme. Something about it doesn't rub me the right way. Okay. And I later found out that it was U2. Bono and the Edge fucking composes, and now it all made perfect sense. It was like, take everything I hate about movies with Dench and everything I hate about music with Bono and just make a mega...
That song might as well have been written by John Barry. It's not as bad as you're making it out to be.
I like where they're going with it, though, because it's sort of like this callback, especially like it kind of mirrors Goldfinger in a way. Like, the whole movie, to me, the fact that they use GoldenEye, like, it's really this callback to old Bond, and sort of to have this, you know, Tina Turner, like, this kind of black soultry voice singing the main
theme. Yeah, she's trying to evoke Angela Bassett.
Yeah, it's definitely, totally. It's like, definitely a throwback, and the framework works, like, and, like, the style... Just something about the execution doesn't work, you know?
Is this the first non-Maurice Binder opening
sequence?
Probably.
I mean, he was old as shit, so I would assume,
I mean, like, with the exception of, like, Never Say Never Again and things like that, but, I mean, this was, like, the first...
Yeah,
like,
Canon Eon production that did not have a Maurice Binder type
And
of
I thought, of all the Brosnan openings, it was my personal favorite. I like all the... Because this is the first, like, post-Cold War Bond movie.
Yeah.
So it's nice to see this sort of like fall of the Cold War, and there's one woman with anvils and sickles and hammers.
The women are taking down all the statues.
Yeah, I actually
really
like all the Brosnan ones.
Oh, no, I like them all, but I think this one sticks out of my mind. Maybe it's just because I've seen it the most that I like it the most.
The one thing that does rub me wrong about the GoldenEye theme song, as much as I like it, I don't quite like the synthesized orchestration. At the time, I didn't even realize that it's not orchestral, but listening to it more recently...
Is this part of the score or just the opening song?
The opening song of
I didn't even recognize
the GoldenEye theme song. Yeah. It sounds very... Very synthesized
like
to me. Yeah.
That may be part of why it didn't feel right to me.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Well, the next movie was Tomorrow Never Dies.
Whose intro as a transition is amazing.
Yeah, probably the best part of the movie.
It is like my third favorite theme song, actually. I don't know why, but like I feel like Sheryl Crow just knocked it out of the park.
Yeah.
Like with this song.
Oh, when you said intro, I thought you were talking about him on the like with the airplane and the
flying the plane that was going to explode.
Oh,
which is really
which
good.
Is awesome.
Yeah, really it's good. Like there's missiles that are shot at this airbase and right after they're shot, it comes to everybody's attention that there are actually nuclear warheads
on a jet.
Yeah. And like Bond is, instead of being like, shit,
this is, you know, this needs to not happen, he's just like, well, I'm just gonna get this plane out of here.
Yeah.
So he jumps in the plane,
fuck shit up,
and like just like turns on like the Gatling guns and like fucks everything up, and then he gets the hell out of there.
And that's, I think, awesome. They said if the nukes had exploded, it would have been like worse than Chernobyl. Something.
They said that the missile wouldn't set off the nukes, but the level of like dirty bomb esque nature of blowing all that material up into the atmosphere would have been the bad.
He takes these missiles that are locked onto the nuclear weapon plane, and he's flying around with missiles following him, but at the same time he's trying to evade capture from all these, like,
and there's
Russian
a guy
agents.
In the co-pilot seat.
Right, there's a guy strangling him from behind.
He's in a plane with the co-pilot, and he's trying to kill him.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Definitely starts strong.
Not a good plan on the co-pilot's part,
killing
the pilot.
Yeah.
But I think the Russian agent was actually the girl from The Living Daylights, or... Which one was it?
Oh, who just like, couldn't
that crashes
fly a plane.
The plane. He's just like, well, I don't know what happens if I strangle the only other pilot.
But aside from the opening, which is great, the rest of the movie's like kind of okay. It had some memorable moments. Like, I know the motorcycle chase where they're handcuffed together.
It's
pretty good.
Michelle Yeoh comes through.
Yeah, shout out for her.
Definitely one of the more like ass-kicking girls.
Oh, yeah. Because
she's fucking like kung fu.
And I think she's actually, some people would disagree, but I think she's actually quite beautiful.
Yeah.
Like,
absolutely.
She's a very talented woman to begin with, which helps a lot.
She's not the kind you like rail in the sauna, but like she's definitely like pretty beautiful.
She's pretty. I wouldn't use the word beautiful, but she's definitely pretty.
I don't know. I would rail her in a sauna. but I mean, when you put her in a movie with Zhang Ziyi, you tend to forget it real quick.
She's had this sort of like...
It's like, I'm a cute Asian girl. Oh, there's a cuter one. Fuck.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you don't forget it in this movie because the other girl is Terry Hatcher.
Yeah.
I fucking hate her.
And you just go, oh, wow, Terry.
And she gets killed.
But lucky for us, Brosnan hates her too.
Yeah, she gets killed by Vincent Schiavelli, which is awesome.
Yeah, it's by Jonathan Pryce, right? So the main villain of the movie is Jonathan Pryce.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who I actually like. He's one of my more liked actors. Like, I think he's great. But in this movie, I don't know if it's him or just the plot in general of him being this sort of like news mogul
or like Truman Show terrorist. Style with a beret.
It gets like a little too corny for my taste. Where it's like signing off. Like, it's kind of dumb. Like, I don't know.
Yeah, he's not one of my favorite villains. You know, that's the whole thing about Tomorrow Never Dies. I feel like it's this weird middle child where you're sort of like, you're stuck in between GoldenEye, which is fantastic, and then you have like the next ones coming up, which aren't good really at all. And then,
I don't hate World Is Not Enough.
I don't hate World Is Not Enough either. It's sort of bland.
I kind of hate it.
I didn't like that at all.
But like Tomorrow Never Dies to me, just story wise, is completely lacking. But it. Action-wise, it pretty much delivers with everything it tries to pull off.
I don't think it lacks story-wise.
Really?
I think the villain's plan is pretty cool, and, like, I think he's a cool villain. Like, don't get me wrong, I think they could have done more with it, but I wouldn't say that it's necessarily lacking. I like it. Like, I like the setup, and I like the fact that, like, it's a media mogul, and, like, he basically creates news. Like, that's the business that he's in. Mm-hmm. And he's just like, well, we're gonna fuck shit up. Like there's reason behind his crimes.
You know, the whole opening scene where like the ship's off course because they rigged the GPS, and they shoot down the Chinese MiGs with British missiles, and then you know they sink the British ship, and then while the British are coming out, they shoot all the British survivors in the water with Chinese machine guns and bullets. They're getting the whole thing set up where it can only look like it's one way. And then they're, you know, they've got all the exclusive footage and you know, photographs. And so, you know, they're using it to make news. But they also show that Jonathan Pryce's character is into other things.
Yeah.
Like other weird, twisted things like releasing operating systems with bugs in it so that people will keep having to upgrade their software.
Like, he's almost like his own, like, digital specter.
Which,
he's got all those people.
Yeah, that's
you
what
almost
I was
feel
say,
like
yeah.
what just happened was, like, one of the writers just got Windows 98, and he was, like, really pissed off. He's like, you know what? I'm going to put this in the movie.
Yeah, he's like, I bet Bill Gates did this shit on purpose.
Is this the one with Ricky J?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
He's good.
He's
no
great.
Nonsense
he's always great.
He would make it. Like, I guess he's, like, sort of a Bond villain, but as, like, a lead Bond villain, I think he would be awesome. awesome.
Yeah. He would have been a better... He could have replaced Price in this, I think, and done a better
job. He could have.
They should have maybe
but
switched
But I kind of like him as the guy that's like in control and never screws anything up.
And he doesn't care about all the blathering and talking that Jonathan Pryce actually does.
He Bond breaks into his safe. It's got the GPS decoder, but it's also got like a ton of drugs and porno magazines.
Yeah,
they said he was some like ex hippie Berkeley genius, right?
Yeah.
The one thing we definitely need to talk about, because it was so set up in GoldenEye, this car with all these awesome features in GoldenEye. They spent a couple minutes talking about how great this car is, and they never do anything with it. So now in Tomorrow Never Dies, they go through this whole big thing with this awesome car. And we just get this explosive, 15-minute sequence of this car.
Yeah. One of my favorite car chases.
iPod Touch controller.
I think that this car, as far as, from a practicality standpoint, this is probably my favorite car.
For functionality,
Visually, it's kind of really ugly, but...
Yeah. I don't really understand why it didn't have bulletproof windshield and, rear window, but...
I thought it had a bulletproof front window, but not a bulletproof back window.
Well, but the window, the missile, it gets shot out, and then the missile goes
straight through,
so
front and back.
So, it can't be bulletproof, but it was awesome, and I remember, as a kid... pretending I had a cell phone that, could drive around a full size car. Another thing about that whole car scene brings up Avis, which is interesting because Patrick O'Reilly was actually telling me that this movie was completely funded by sponsorships.
By product placement.
Literally the entire budget of the film was covered by product placement.
First time in film history that's
For a feature length theatrically released film, it's the first time that the entire budget was covered by product placement.
Which is crazy to me because I remember product placement, but it doesn't feel like a Michael Bay movie.
Yeah, certainly more subtle than the Mountain Dew.
Or the Island.
Or an Xbox.
Yeah, that's a pretty huge landmark for film history. I mean, product placement's always been there, but for such an expensive movie to be
$110 million
they found somewhat logical ways to work it into the plot. Avis thing was he's returning the car.
And BMW.
It's not like Torque where they're just in front of Mountain Dew and Pepsi for no reason. Yeah.
Honestly, at that point though, considering the job that James Bond had done on Aston Martin's reputation, of course BMW is going to throw $10 million at the next James Bond movie.
That's true.
Put our car in it. Here you go. And
and our motorcycle
it,
too. Yeah, they're riding a BMW motorcycle too, aren't they?
Yeah.
Oh, right.
Yeah, it's just amazing that films that utilize way less fundage for they receive way less money for their product placement, it seems so much more prominent.
Yeah.
The fact that this is fully covered and somehow doesn't feel that.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's pretty awesome. Pretty cool.
I read that Ricky Jay's character was, because he's something of a magician in the film and in reality. And there was going to be scenes where he would throw cards at James Bond to hurt him. And so they were doing test scenes where he was 15 to 20 feet away. And they would say, throw a card at Pierce. And he's like, well, I don't want to hurt him. And they're like, well, I mean, just throw it lightly. And so he threw one lightly and it cut Pierce Brosnan.
Wow.
And they were like, okay, we're not going to have you throw cards in this movie. We appreciate that you can do it, but there's no way for us to protect people from it.
Yeah, I've seen footage of Ricky Jay. He can throw a playing card into a watermelon, which is ridiculous.
What, is he fucking Gambit? How does
basically,
he do that?
A card, just a regular playing card will, he can actually get it to stick into a watermelon. He can cut carrots. It's crazy. This guy's a fucking
weapon.
That's
amazing.
Yeah.
He's a real odd job.
Yeah.
Is amazing.
Of course, the cards are made of razor sharp metal.
Razor sharp razors.
Which he fires from a gun.
And the watermelons are made of paper. Also, I'm jumping back a lot, but I wanted to make this point really badly, and then I forgot when View to a Kill came out. When they're up at the top of the bridge in the blimp the first time, or Zeppelin or whatever it is, when they're going past the Golden Gate Bridge the first time, it's probably the worst referencing of the title within the movie of any of the James Bond films, when Grace Jones looks out the window and she says, "What a view," and then Chris Walken leans in and says, "To a Kill." It's just so awkward and out of place. It's just wait, what, really? But other than that, none of the titles, the speaking of them in the movie, jumped out at me.
Well, I don't think they ever say Tomorrow Never Dies.
Well, his name is Tomorrow, wasn't it? or no?
Well, it was the newspaper's name.
Well, yeah, it was like Tomorrow's News Today.
Right. Yeah.
It
was like. But I thought the original title was Tomorrow Never Lies, and there was a typo at some point, and they liked it better as Dies.
Really?
Like
Tomorrow Never. Oh, I see.
Because his newspaper is always correct.
There wasn't there a TV show where the dude got it was like early edition and he like got there's a show
he would get
where,
the next day's newspaper every
he would get the next day's newspaper today and be like, oh shit, I gotta go save Billy from the well, and like it was
what, like Marty McFly was his paper boy, like
I get, they the show never explained like why
it just
ended up at his doorstep
and he could
whoa.
Set his alarm as early as he wanted, but he's always gonna groundhog it, wake up to, you know, Sonny and Cher.
Little did he know he was getting Jonathan Pryce's paper. And that's how he knew.
Falling into the villain's plan.
But there are a lot of cool little things in this movie. The stealth boat, based on the actual stealth boat that the military has, which is a cool concept for anything. I mean, a stealth boat.
Yeah, which was also used in Street Fighter the movie.
Same boat.
Same boat.
Which it's just wow. Like such a crazy concept because you would think that a boat would already be below radar, but I guess it's not. So I thought that was pretty sweet. Jonathan Bryce gets drilled by the drill. We didn't talk about the drill yet, did we? The drill.
No.
That turns completely 90 degrees when inside the narrow corridors of his ship somehow.
He could just turn it like fucking Pac-Man through the ship.
Right, it was to like sink the sub, right? It would just
they were
somehow
the destroyer.
It needs a hole for the metal.
Like
which
you know,
makes sense when you're coming from water.
Of course.
But once you're inside the ship, you lose steering capability.
Yeah, it just seemed like if it just went straight to the ship, it would do as much damage as...
chasing people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, fuck it, eating a cherry and then chasing Russians through a ship. Yeah.
One thing I liked, like, we kind of touched on the motorcycle and kind of touched on the helicopter, but the end of, like how they finished that chase awesome.
Yeah.
Like, we really need to just mention that. Like
the helicopter that's been chasing them... It turns, well, not turns, it leans and tilts and advances on them in an alleyway. The threat of decapitation by the helicopter blades is imminent, and it's so intense.
It was like Planet Terror or something.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It's Planet Terror. What happened later, and it also happened in 28
weeks
later.
Yeah.
It made good on that threat there, and it wasn't completely necessary to do it here, but it was incredible. And I remember seeing Planet Terror and 28 Weeks Later because they came out in the same year, and at the time I had completely forgotten about Tomorrow Never Dies.
Yeah.
But there it was again.
Bond beat him to it.
Yeah, beat him to it years ahead of time, and it was just so effective because it's really there. And then they throw not a clothesline or a grappling hook or something.
It was some kind of line that went across the alleyway.
And toss it into the rudder.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
They drove the motorcycle. Yeah, exactly. They drove the motorcycle directly towards the helicopter.
Yeah.
Skid under it.
Oh, yeah.
And then, like, through the other end of it, of the rope or whatever, into
the
rear rotor.
Yep.
And, like, it just fucked it up.
Which doesn't make a lot of sense.
But it's great for a movie.
Because if you think about it, a helicopter rotor is a circle, and the alley is square. So there is a big section where the circle isn't coming anywhere near. They could have just walked through it, but
that
would
have been
it's not
really
as impressive.
Thank God
Richard doesn't direct Bond movies.
What are we gonna do? Let's
if,
go
if the
around.
Alley, if the alley had
drive on the road, I don't see it. It's paved. Like,
had the alley been like curved to match the circumference of
that would have made so much more sense, Richard.
But we'll skip that.
This is also the same alley where I remember, just sort of as a final note or close to the end, is that Bond and Michelle Yeoh, like her character, they get like handcuffed or something to like a water pipe.
Yeah,
like
she cuffs Bond.
Okay, she
to the water pipe.
Well,
yeah, they're showering.
She
together.
Gets
they're
out
showering,
of
right?
And yeah,
and she picks the lock
she,
first.
Yeah,
she picks the lock, and then like Bond just breaks that poor person's plumbing.
Oh yeah,
it's not even indoor plumbing. This person has just gotten their first water pipe.
They're clearly in like third world
area.
It
was like 2 years of
it was slums. It was slums.
It was the poor side of town.
Yeah, and like Bond just takes indoor plumbing from this poor family.
Takes it away like a god.
Yeah, he just rips his handcuff off their like shitty little pipe that provides so much joy to that family.
and then
just walks away like whatever.
And then he goes through the painstaking process of following her two doors down to her secret hideout.
Hey, I got out.
What's up?
What's going on here? You got a computer. It's hidden.
What's all this then?
That's neat.
It's all red.
That's cool.
Because you're Chinese.
Yeah. You know what? I didn't make that connection, but all of our computer thing stuff is red, and she is Chinese.
Yep.
Racist.
Excellent. Anything else about Tomorrow Never Dies?
No, except that I probably should be going now.
We're going to have to say goodbye to Pat, which is unfortunate because we've been teasing the big...
It's okay. Correct. I've been throwing in my two cents here and there on why.
So there's no final comments you want to make about Craig or anything
in general?
Daniel Craig is an awful James Bond. He's basically, he's Bourne, and they just wanted to make a Bourne movie with their Eon license, and so they put a blonde guy who's not James Bond in a James Bond movie.
That's all.
Boo!
Yeah, boo on that.
Get out, good riddance! Farewell.
All right, well, that's going to do it for part 4 of the James Bond Cinemarathon. Tune in next time for our final James Bond podcast, part 5, which will conclude the Bond Marathon. I know you await with bated breath. We will see you then.